You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins. Today is a good day, and that is because we have Kevin Seconds on this particular podcast, which I am thrilled to say because 7 Seconds, huge band for me, huge band I know for many, many people because they were on the ground floor, you know, as far as like the early 80s, you know, hardcore scene is concerned. They were definitely the band that was doing it, you know, like just off the heels of Minor Threat and everything else that was happening in the 80s. 7 Seconds were huge, and they did what they did in their own weird corner of the world, which was Reno, Nevada. I mean, like, it's just you'll hear Kevin articulate and speak why he was living in Reno and like how interesting that whole scene was. But there are so many things about this band where, you know, realistically, we shouldn't be talking about these guys anymore, but because they left such a long-lasting legacy, and let's talk about the crew. The reason that we are having Kevin on this show is because Trust Records, a great record label that is documenting some amazing records and re-releasing them, making sure that they are available to everybody that cares about them. Trust Records re-released The Crew. That is out on, you know, it's like gatefold vinyl. It's out on every streaming provider around because that record was just not available. You would not be able to find it. And that's a crime. Like, you want people to be able to listen to what others would define as, you know, a really important record in a band's catalog. Of course, you could find tons of other 7 Seconds out there, which is great, but The Crew and Trust Records, they have brought this to life. And so Kevin came on this podcast, and so exciting. But another exciting thing, first of all, email the show. You can always email the show at 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. I love to hear from you, guest ideas, whatever the case may be. We're approaching 8 years of this podcast, which is incredible to say. And I have to thank you for it. You know, you guys, the listener, I'm pointing to you and you and you have definitely changed my life in a positive way for me to be able to continue to do this show and support it in so many ways. Like, it is not lost on me because it's really important for me to continue to do this, not because this is like a money-making endeavor, but because I find this music scene and this whole DIY punk and hardcore scene to be incredibly important to me and foundational, and I want to be able to instill that in others and give them more stories about people that are involved with this. So anyways, let me get off my soapbox, but let me get right back on because I want to talk to you. I watched this film called Summer of Soul. It comes out, I want to say, in a week or so, but I mean, regardless, when you're listening to it, Google it, find it, immediately watch it. It is an incredible documentary done by, or is, I think, the producer on it, Questlove. This is a music event I was never aware of. And, you know, I by no stretch of the imagination am some like musical historian nerd. If you want to talk to me about, you know, mid-90s metalcore, I'll go pretty deep with you. But, you know, I know enough to be dangerous. But the Harlem Soul Festival, Music Festival, I can't remember the exact title of it, but this happened at the same time as Woodstock. And we're talking about tens of thousands of people that flocked to this free concert in a park in Harlem in New York City in 1969. And this whole documentary shows unearthed footage, stuff that people have never seen from like Stevie Wonder, the, you know, the Mavis Staples and her dad, and just so many incredible Sly and the Family Stone. There were so many things that just blew my mind. It was like, honestly, every 10 to 15 minutes, I sat back as I was watching the documentary and I was like, dude, are you kidding me? Like, I can't believe we are watching this. I can't believe I am watching this. And it was really great too, because it was also setting it in a historical context while sharing amazing music with you. It was also sharing the social relevance behind what made this thing so special and why maybe people aren't talking about it anymore. And so this documentary is crucial viewing as far as I'm concerned. So everybody should go out and pursue to watch that documentary in whatever way, shape, or form you can. So again, the movie is called Summer of Soul, and it's an incredible documentary. It's about 2 hours long, totally, totally engaging the entire time. So watch it, okay? Anyways, let's dive into Kevin Seconds, okay? Great dude, great conversation, and we go places. So it was really fun. Here we are with Kevin Seconds.
I I'm sure that this story, you know, has not is not unique, but I'm sure just makes you laugh because, you know, my I'm 40 years old. My first band, aptly named Doom Society, which of course you could probably close your eyes and hear the terrible punk music coming out. But we covered Young Till I Die, what's funny is because I got into that via, and I'm sure you've heard this before, there's a hardcore band called Battery that covered Young Till I Die. And so I, you know, sort of reverse engineered it where like, oh, I like this Battery cover of the 7 second song. And then, yeah. And so I'm sure it feels interesting for you to kind of hear the generational influence where it's like, you know, like I had a general awareness of what's who 7 seconds was, but it wasn't until, you know, another band sort of held my hand to be like, oh no, like you need to get into these guys. Right. Is that, you know, where does that sit in your head? Is it just like wild? The fact that, you know, you could still be existing in the, you know, punk rock hardcore ecosystem where it's like, oh yeah, people, you know, the name still resonates, or, you know, how does it kind of sit in your head? I realize that's a big question, but.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a good question. I you know, it's funny because at a fairly early stage in our little history, I always talk about how the term legendary is always sort of overused from, you know, like I almost hate the term, but I remember we'd been playing for like 5 years and I kept seeing flyers, a legendary 7 seconds. I'm like, wow, we're already legendary. What does this mean? Like we're almost over, you know, but I realized early on that there was like a whole new, especially with the sort of the 1988 youth crew stuff, that kind of got younger kids interested in us because of the bands that they did that were kind of from part of that scene. And those bands sort of grew up listening to us. And so even though I thought we were relevant, we were touring all the time, making records, you know, it was, you know, only maybe 7-8 years after we had started that people were always going, oh yeah, you know, you guys are like the godfathers of it. I'm like, well, we're not that old. I mean, we're older than the, so, I don't know. I think it's great. I feel like maybe I'm not even answering your question, but I think if younger bands come up and are showing a sort of appreciation for some of the bands that they loved and grew up with, and it exposes that band's music to a younger crowd or younger generation, I think it's great. And we certainly have benefited from that. And, I got no complaints with that. I think it's pretty cool. It is wild because again, you know, we really, up until we, you know, just before we broke up, we really were still staying busy, you know, and we were trying to be as active as possible, that, you know, active as a bunch of 50-year-old guys could be, I guess. But it's all been great, and I can't complain about a single thing. We've just gotten so much support and love over the years. I'm just eternally grateful, no matter what.
Right. Well, it is funny. I mean, I'm glad you brought up the notion of, you know, not being put out to pasture, but just the idea that like we've been a band for 5 years and we're considered legendary. Like,
right.
That is a weird, you know, I don't care what age you are, like being called legendary, like that's just kind of weird, you know.
it just automatically, I mean, you know, people do it in a compliment. They do it in a, it's all loving and a wonderful, you know, they think they're being respectful, but it's really kind of like, you know, you hear legendary and it's like, well, no, like Rolling Stones are legendary, or even like maybe the Misfits are legendary, you know, at this point, Black Flag's legendary, you know. I feel like if you're still active and you're still, you know, making new music and that kind of stuff, it's like, I want to, you know, if you want to call me legendary, once it's all, we're put to pasture, that's fine with me. But hey, you can call me legend. Yeah. If you want to call me legendary now, that's perfectly fine. I have no complaints about it, but it is funny when you're younger and you're getting that kind of stuff.
Right.
Heaped on your head. You're like, whoa, do we have something? Should we be dressing better? Should we try to rehearse more? I don't know.
Right. Should we be more professional? Yeah.
Right. It's like legendary. That's a pretty big word.
Right. Totally. And especially too, where it's like, you know, that word being applied to you, but it's just like, hey, I'm like 26. Like this really doesn't feel legendary. Like what?
Yeah. Well, I remember having a conversation like that with Ray of today, from Youth of Today. And, you know, they had really started to kind of blow up a little bit within the underground scene or whatever. And I remember him sort of communicating to me that he was really struggling with all the sort of adulation. I was like, well, you know, it's just, I guess it's part of it, you know, and either you have to get good at balancing, that with the when you get panned and people really go after your band or after you for something you said or some music that you made. And but he was, I think he was like 24 or something, and he was already going like, oh, I don't know, this is I don't know if I'm up for this or not, you know.
Well, I was going to ask, I was actually going to ask this a little bit later, but it seems apropos to bring up now, just the, you know, that notion of your identity being tied so closely to the art that you create, and then, you know, doing your best to, you know, stay grounded. And of course, like, that can mean so many different things, because clearly no one in the hardcore and punk scene is like, you know, of the same level as, you know, Madonna or whatever. Like, but there still is that, you know, notion of being, of people watching you grow up. And, you know, kind of like the child actor scenario where it's like, oh, geez, like, you know, here's you bearing your soul, you know, with your own personal art. So how, you know, were you kind of, I guess, aware as the band, you know, started to receive some attention? And how did you, I guess, kind of be able to battle that notion of like buying into like, oh, I'm Kevin Seconds. I mean, I know that is literally your name, your not your God-given name, but your
right.
But how'd you separate those two things?
I don't know. I think we were surprised the whole time. Like every single good thing that would happen, just we'd all go, holy shit, that's great. You know, like my brother and I started this, you know, in our bedroom that we shared at my mom's old apartment. And it was always like, you know, we were such like little rock band dreamer guys before we got into punk. And then when punk happened, I always say that the reason I think that it was such I was so drawn to it was that when I was like following all of these big time rock, metal, hardcore, you know, hard rock bands of the, you know, 70s or whatever, I loved them and I was passionate about their music, but I never quite felt like I could be part of whatever they were doing, you know? And so it was always like, you'd see, you know, photos of Jimmy Page and Robert Plant getting off a private jet, you know, and you're like, that's never really going to be me. And it's not even what I want, you know? So like the punk rock thing just kind of opened the door to like, hey, this is a little more like realistic and reasonable, and the music's great, and I and it was coming from younger people, so it just really made it, it just resonated with me, and I just sort of felt like, so this means that we're not supposed to be rock stars. This means that we're not supposed to be inaccessible and stuck up and egotistical and stuff. And so I just always try to tell myself that, even at moments where I, you know, maybe was being, I let my ego get carried away, or I got a little, hey, maybe I am something special. You know, I got really good at keeping myself even, I guess, you know, and even in the moments where things were looking really good and people were blowing smoke up our asses or whatever, you know, at first I'd be like, yes. But then I'd be like, hold on a second. You know, like there's bound to be, this is going to turn on us at some point, or this is going to, you know, go away at some point. And yet we're still going to need to be, you know, active and writing and playing and recording and touring and stuff. And so I just kind of followed that, you know. I thought anytime I sensed it coming from a bandmate, I'd sort of try to politely, respectfully say, hey, you know what, let's always remember that, you know, this is fun and that we got into this for a certain reason, and that we're, you know, we always want to keep that as the core of why we do what we do, you know. And and I like to think we did. I don't think we ever got too carried away with the ego stuff, hopefully.
Yeah, well, and especially too with the era in which you came up in, like that, the notion of being a career band, like, you know, that didn't even exist. Like
absolutely.
Which we'll pull in that thread a little bit later, but kind of, you know, putting the focus on you as an individual. I know you were born and raised in Sacramento, and then, you know, moved to Reno when you were your teenager and stuff. Mm-hmm. Sacramento is and you reside there currently. That's a really interesting city, because it's this, you know, weird hodgepodge of, you know, being the capital city, but then there's also a ton of rural areas, and it's just this interesting sort of small town, big town conglomeration. Did you find that experience, like, as you were kind of growing up, being like, oh yeah, like I'm in a big town, but also not really?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, growing up, you know, we lived in we went to the whole gamut of living sort of when my parents were together, you know, very suburban, boring, bland. And then when they got divorced, my mom was just raising us, and it was all just shitty apartment complexes. And the good thing about that is that we were just being raised, you know, around other, and, you know, becoming friends with other poor kids, you know, and of all walks of life. So that, I think had we just stayed in the suburban sort of thing, I don't think we would have been exposed to all kinds of different stuff, but we were. And now I always think that that was a good thing ultimately in the end. But yeah, Sacramento, you're right. It's this sort of, you know, there's a very keen sense of state politics, and, you know, every other friend works for the state and works in some government oriented office. But then if you veer just like 20 miles north or south, it's just Trump, you know, it's very conservative, very like, you know, crazy, you know. So, and where I live, you know, I live basically in the Midtown section, and we're really, it's a bubble. It's just this big, you know, woke liberal, you know, bubble, which I'm good with, you know. But yeah, it's just it's an interesting city. You know, there've been a lot of great musicians coming out of the area, and it's just big enough to where it doesn't feel like, I don't ever feel like I'm kept from experiencing something I want. But it's also, I like the small town, you know, I like the, I don't think I could live in a city bigger than Sacramento. I've tried, and it's just, yeah, I start to feel a little lost and weird.
So. Sure. Well, I mean, you know, that comes with age, where, you know, you feel your calibration and you're like, okay, this is too small. This is too big. Like, here we go. Right. This feels like the mix.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I didn't know. I don't know if I would have cared either way as a kid, but, you know, as I've gotten older, I've definitely, I appreciate living in a neighborhood where there's, you know, oh, look, we have trees, and, you know, we live in a house that was built in 1919 or something, you know. So it's like you start to appreciate that kind of stuff. When I was a kid, I wouldn't have given a shit about any of that stuff, you know. So,
right. Yeah. That's not important. And so what was your family structure like as you were growing up? I mean, like you said, your parents got divorced. I don't know what age that happened, and I know you have a younger brother, but, you know, what was the structure like as you were coming up?
I, you know, my parents divorced when I was 11. So I have a vague memory of my dad. He was, you know, he was a good guy. He was a cop when I was born. And then, he was, I think, 20 years older than my mom. So he had already been in World War II. He was a hero in the war, came home injured, got sent back, and highly decorated. And then he decided to pursue law enforcement. And then he met my mom, who was a bit of a, you know, college, Berkeley, you know, graduate, you know, had trained to play music, piano classically, which she was always sort of regretting that she didn't follow that through. And then was kind of, you know, caught up in the hippie culture of the 60s, counterculture of the 60s. So she was really pretty much very socially active and aware. And when they divorced, my mom was adamant, you know, she wanted custody of us, and we were all closer to her. So that was fine with us. And but that was the start of a, you know, single mom raising three young kids, her working, and, you know, us, the minute we were able to work, go right to work, you know. And so it was rough, and it was, you know, it was harrowing at times. I mean, we grew up living in, you know, out of, you know, sort of on the welfare system, and it you know, just like anybody else, it just, you just watching my mom struggle and try to make ends meet, and was tough, but also just seeing the strength that she had to keep us all together under one roof, was enormously inspiring and influential to me later on in life. I just thought, wow, and before she passed away a couple of years ago, you know, I'll constantly, cause she was always sort of beating herself up. Like, I could have been a better mom. I could have been this. I could have been like, you know, you did fine. You know, like we're all relatively, you know, good, wise human beings. You did really good. Don't stop beating, you know, up yourself. But yeah, it just was, I mean, not terribly, you know, unique or anything. We just struggled. And I, you know, I think, when we moved to Reno, we kind of moved to Reno with the idea that we kind of have a do over, like just start everything over again. There was work supposedly. And you know, the rent was cheaper and we could live a little better than we were living in Sacramento at the time. And then that all kind of fell through. So, but once we kind of got upright, and once everybody started to acclimate, and I started working when I was 16, and I realized I liked working and making money more than I liked sitting in a classroom where nobody cared what I was doing or right. How well I did. And then punk rock happened, and that was sort of the, you know, the start of everything, or the end of everything. My little brother Steve and I we just became so, you know, passionate about it, and it just consumed us. And we both already wanted to like become, we wanted to be in, you know, band, we wanted to be musicians and get into bands, but we, again, like I said, we just didn't really quite know how to do that being, you know, underage. That it wasn't like you could start a band and go play anywhere, maybe a battle of the bands here and there, but there was no, we weren't going to be playing in nightclubs, you know? And so when punk rock came along, it really just kind of, I don't know, it just made, it opened our eyes to the possibility that we could, we found there was something that we could do. And that was all we could think about for
sure
forever.
the great awakening, as they call it.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really was.
So, I mean, it sounds like your experience with school was very much that academics were not important to you. You weren't, putting forth your best effort, were you, right, Kevin?
No, not really. And you know, that was the other thing. My mom actually taught English, high school English for a number of years. And so she was always really trying to keep our interest in, you know, in education. And, I was interested in education. I wanted to do better myself. I wanted to do better, but I always felt like I just didn't have that one teacher who inspired me to, you know what I mean? It was just like being babysat and I didn't ever fit in any category. Like I'd have, friends that were stoners or friends that were jocks or whatever. It seemed like everything was about finding a nice place to fit into. And I just, for whatever reason, I just didn't learn how to appreciate, I didn't understand the value in that. I just thought, well, you know, most of my best friends don't even go to the same school I go to. They go to another school, you know, and, you know, I don't know. It seemed always just like such a bummer. You know, you have to get up early, you have to sit through class, and, you know, ultimately, I mean, later on in life, you know, after I started to, you know, live life and stuff, I've gone back and taken courses at like local community college, and I really enjoy it. I'm actually pretty decent at it, and I enjoy the environment and stuff. But boy, when I was a kid, I was just not into it.
Right.
You couldn't find your spot whatsoever. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm guessing that you weren't, you know, attracted to sports. Were you kind of more, you know, an indoor kid, or did you just kind of, you know, just try a little bit of everything?
I was into sports, actually. When I was a kid, I played Little League baseball for a while. Babe Ruth, I wasn't great, but I would make the team. I tried football. I was just too skinny and too little. Pop Warner football. I ran track. I was on a cross country team for a while. It was a independent team called the Striders. It wasn't even a school team. It was just something you could join. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to be good at it because I did have friends that were really super great at, you know, great athletes and stuff. And I just always felt so lame, you know, and they weren't interested in music. Like I loved music as a kid and they were like, yeah, but they liked the radio. And my mom had, you know, an amazing record collection. So I could just pull out anything from crazy old jazz records to like David Bowie, you know, like she'd listen to Motown. She listened to Led Zeppelin. She listened to everything. And so I was so caught up in music by the time I was like, you know, I got into high school that I just didn't relate to anything that was going on, but I did try. I tried my hand at sports. I you know, I really wanted to be good at that, and I just didn't quite pan out.
Sure. And was it? I mean, like when you moved to Reno, I mean, Reno is an insanely weird city. Like, yeah. I mean, this is coming from a person. I was born in Vegas, and like every time I travel up to Reno, it was just like, wow. So this is like a weirder, smaller, somewhat more depressing version of Vegas, even though Vegas can argue that it's a depressing city as well. But I guess tough for you to acclimate to Reno, or did you kind of just like, all right, well, you know, I mean, this is what we have to do. So, you know, I got no choice.
It's a funny thing. I went up 2 weeks before my family moved up there. The story was, and I won't bore you with the details, but the story was, is that we had my mom's best friend was living up there and had a big house. And the idea was, is that she had like four bedrooms or something. And the idea was that we'd move up there, move into the house, share the rent. And then my mom would go to work. And then when I was old enough, I'd go to work. And then we'd eventually move out once we could afford it. Well, the week we got up there, we learned that my mom's friend, her plans had changed. And so we literally were homeless for about 2 weeks. We were living out of our car until we could afford. My mom got a job at McDonald's, and then we got enough money to go live out of a motel for a while. And it was crazy. The whole thing was insane. Then we're talking 76, 77, 78. Rena was really messed up. It was really just all about the gambling. There was nothing. If you were underage, there was just absolutely nothing for you to do. There was nothing to, you know, and it was that way. I mean, I always say, and people who I grew up with in that, or the early stages of the Reno punk rock scene, we all agree that a city like Reno is a perfect place for a flourishing punk rock scene, because same with Vegas, you know, like it makes complete sense that young people would want a place to gather and build a community, because there's absolutely nothing there for you to do after you get out of school. You know, the big thing for us, teenagers, this, and keep in mind, you know, disco was just starting to hit. So there would be all ages events where a disco dance. And I remember my friends would go, "Hey, you want to go with us?" And I'd be like, I went one time and I'm like, I don't like the music. I don't like, everybody's dressed like weird. It's like, and I was already an awkward teenager, so it wasn't like meeting girls was really going to be the, you know, it wasn't going to be, you know, I wasn't going to have probably much luck in that department. So the other thing was everybody would just cruise up and down the main drag, South Virginia Street, on Friday and Saturday nights. And I tried that and it was just like, this is just nowhere. You know, this is just, you know, we're doing nothing here. Nothing's happening, you know. So, yeah, back then it was really, really, really terrible. And over the years, you know, Reno's become, I think, because the emphasis was less on gaming, like the gaming industry kind of died out a little bit. So Reno had to kind of rediscover what the worth of being a city. And so now there's a great art scene up there. There's a great music scene, and it's kind of happening. Anytime I go up there to see friends or family, I really enjoy it, you know. But yeah, as a kid, it was just, I wanted to get out of there so bad. And I, for 10, 11 years, I just worked and in misery, basically. And again, punk rock, you know, really saved my life. I don't know where I would have been had I not had that outlet. I don't know if it's, I would have had any, other interests I would have had, you know. It's kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I mean, I can agree with you that, you know, Reno definitely has the ability to, you know, do what like Detroit and these other cities, that it's like, oh, if we actually invest in the community and like have more exciting things happening, like people actually come here. This is exciting.
Right.
and keep it cheap to live too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, which it's not anymore. It's funny. It's like, you know, I hear about people, I guess we're going to move to California. I'm like, you're moving to California for Reno? Like, how expensive can Reno be? But I guess it's getting pretty expensive up there. But yeah, I mean, once I left, you know, I the whole thing was always just to try and get out of there. The best part of Reno was that when we finally started connecting with people that loved underground music, punk rock music, and there was we started to build up a little scene, then it became really, really nice. It was like, okay, we have a tribe. We have a community. We're not just the outcasts. And, you know, it's not, you know, we're not going to get up if we go and out with this group and, you know, play a record in somebody's house or throw a show in somebody's garage or whatever. And so for a good 10 years, that was really what I focused on. I learned how to put on shows. I learned what you needed to do to put out a fanzine. My sister put out a fanzine, my little brother, everybody in my family had some, you know, we were always doing something, you know, either music or starting zines or, you know, putting shows on and stuff. And so that kept me pretty occupied for the longest time. And then I sort of became this, I became this infamous figure for all the wrong reasons. It was like, all I remember, I put on a show and it wasn't exactly legit. You know, I didn't get the proper entertainment permits and stuff. And it was great. I mean, it was like 100 kids. I think it was like a De Kreutzen show or something. And the cops came and put me in the back of the car and took me downtown. And it was like this big deal, you know, and they really thought they'd score. They thought they had this mastermind who was trying to poison the youth of Reno. And, you know, they couldn't believe it. Like, well, what are you in this for? How much money do you make? And I'm like, I'm not making anything. I'll be lucky if I get, you know, the 20 bucks I put in for a flyer and the whatever the cost it was to rent the place I had. And they were like, you know, they just couldn't believe I didn't do drugs. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. They were like, come on, what's your deal here, buddy? And it was like, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm really the most boring person. And you know, you don't have a hardened criminal. You just got,
right. I just want to do this thing. Right.
You just have this dumb shit that's, you know, that loves this music and is just trying to, you know, make time here in Reno a little more appealing, I guess, and whatnot. But
Yeah, yeah. No, that's funny. Especially, yeah. Yeah, especially in a town like Reno, where it's like, you know, most people are, you know, viewed as degenerates. Where it's like, oh, you got to be into something bad, of course.
I remember saying that. I'm like, isn't there enough? Isn't there like some kind of meth related crime that's going on right now that you guys are missing because you've got me, you know, here trying? They were always trying to tie us into like gang, some kind of a gang thing or cult thing, you know, and it was always like, It was so naive. Everybody was so naive about what punk rock was and what the symbols were and why we spray paint and stuff. You know, they always had this deeper meaning, and it really didn't. It was just bored kids who just – we were looking for any way to have fun and express ourselves, and they couldn't quite understand that. It wasn't the –
Yeah, it didn't make sense in their head. No. I get that.
Oh, boy. Band merch is important, right? It's important to you. It's important to me. It's important to this whole DIY – lifestyle that we live. Lifestyle determines my death style. Anytime I say lifestyle, I'll feel like, oh man, it's some cheese ball branding thing. But you know, it's not a cheese ball branding thing. Rockabilly.com. That is because they are the best provider of merch on the internet, as far as I'm concerned. And what I want to do is give you 10% off. Use this code 100 words. It gets you 10% off. It will, you know, make you cooler amongst your friends, because not only are you getting them the latest and greatest band merch that exists, but it's all officially licensed. The band gets paid, and plus you get 10% off. So 100 words, use that code. And Rockabilia is, they just know exactly what they're doing. They can ship this stuff out to you quickly, efficiently. If you have any issues whatsoever, just write them real quick. Boom, they solve that problem. It's amazing. I've ordered multiple times from them, and I continue to order from them because I believe in this company so wholeheartedly. So again, go to rockabilia.com, use that promo code 100 words, gets you 10% off, sends them the info that you heard about it from the show. Everybody wins in this scenario. So rockabilia.com, band merch is your life. Fulfill that closet, or fulfill, how about fill the closet? All right. Thanks.
And kind of, you know, on that idea of, you know, coming from a sort of musical household, as far as, you know, all of the different, you know, artistic influences that were playing into, you know, what you were getting into, who would you kind of view as your musical Sherpa, as it were, where it's like, you know, because you were definitely, you know, at the ground floor of the, you know, hardcore punk rock movement, because, like, you know, now you look at it and it's like, well, I find it weird when people don't get exposed to it, where it's like, what do you mean you haven't heard of that? Even though it's but, you know, so I guess, how were you discovering a lot of this stuff? Was it just, you know, like kind of you and your younger brother bouncing stuff back and forth? Was there a local record store? How did you kind of come about that?
At first there was nothing. And then we heard, we were living out of a little motel in Sparks, Nevada. And my entire family was, both my mom and I had jobs at McDonald's. And it was pretty depressing. And one night we were watching TV, and there was some kind of special on the punk invasion in England. And it was just, you know, crazy. It might have even been black and white. I don't even remember, but it was just like crazy footage. The camera crews went in, and the Sex Pistols were playing. You could kind of see the band, but they were mostly focusing on the crowd who were gobbing, you know, spitting at each other, and they had chains around their necks and safety pins in their mouths, and there was something between the just the crazy loud music that was almost indecipherable, but it just had such an intense, immediate sort of like, wow, that's like really intense, whatever this music is they're making. But and also the fact that it was just all youth based, it was all kids that were putting everything together. And in this little teeny 10-minute, 15-minute segment, it just sparked so much in me. I remember sitting there, and my family, a friend of our families was there watching it with us. And I mean, it was just like, he thought it was just like, he was like, what is this garbage? Or, you know, he just thought it was awful. Oh, and they had the lyrics to like God Save the Queen. Like they had it superimposed, you know, they were showing the lyrics because you couldn't understand anything. And I had no idea really why a band would be talking about the Queen, or, you know, why she's not a human being. You know, like I just didn't understand the concept whatsoever. And so I couldn't stop thinking about it. I remember going to work, and I was asking people I worked with if they had heard anything, and they didn't know what I was talking about. Everybody was looking at me like I was like a, you know, just a Martian or something. And then I was trying to find any information, and it took me months really to even get any – I think it was there was a Rolling Stone article on the kind of on the same thing, but they went into depth and they interviewed Johnny Rotten, I think. And I just, everything about it just appealed to me. Everything appealed to me. And I think with my little brother, he was always such my best friend, but he was like my little tag along brother. So anything that I had an interest in, he kind of immediately adopted. And then my sister was, she was really into it. I think she was the first one in the family that actually bought Never Mind the Bollocks. She was working, and I remember I was waiting for a paycheck, and I talked her into buying it when it first came out because I didn't have the money, and she did it. And I remember us going home and listening to it. My mom was at work, and we were listening to it. We were listening to the song Bodies, which is just so, it was so insanely shocking. And we just kept playing it over and over again, and we were all just like, I think first we were laughing and going, listen to this. But then it was like, there's something about the intensity that just really appealed to all of us and stuff. And I remember my mom hearing it later, and she's like, what are you guys listening to? Like, she wasn't even trying to tell us we couldn't listen to it. She just didn't understand what it was about. And so, yeah, that was, I think it was this TV show. And then just kind of looking through, trying to find any kind of mention of it in rock magazines. Cream was really good. Cream magazine, Rolling Stone, they were really good. They'd had a couple of writers that would always kind of mention it a lot. Lester Bangs was talking about it a lot. He was, back then I loved anything that he wrote. So it was kind of like just through the, we also were in Reno. There was no, media wise that we were like 5-10 years behind everybody else. So there was no way really to find that out unless you sought it. You went out. Right.
You're looking for scraps of the table. You were just like anything, a lifeline.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then I remember finally the record stores would start carrying what they'd have a new wave section. So there'd be like Blondie and Talking Heads and stuff. And, I bought all of that stuff, but I was like, nah, this isn't what I'm looking for. And then finally, the funny thing was that the first Sex Pistols, when the Sex Pistols album was released in America, the record store that we were going to got a box of them, but refused to put them out on display because they were worried about, I think they were worried about a legal thing maybe. But now I think back and I'm like, well, maybe it was just a publicity stunt. Maybe they just figured if they kept it from the few people that would want those records, it would just create more of a buzz about it and stuff, which it kind of did. But I remember begging the guy, I'm like, please, can we just buy it now? And he's like, no, we don't want to get in trouble. And we're like, well, you have the records here. Why won't you sell it to us? So yeah, it was just kind of, there was this big buzz around it that I didn't quite understand. And I just was adamant. I wasn't going to take no for an answer. And eventually we found in the back of, I think, Cream magazine, there were ads about you could order records and tapes. And we found a guy that was selling bootleg live Sex Pistol and Clash cassettes and Buzzcocks and the Jam and all that stuff. And so we started to buy these like cassettes from this guy in New York. We just mail order it. And that really helped out because then not only could we hear the bands, the songs, but we could hear them, what they sounded like live. And it all sounded like shit. It was like, poorly recorded or whatnot. But again, that just built up the allure. That just made me love it more. Now reflecting on that, I've talked to 100 people that I know that grew up musicians, who said kind of the same thing. They experienced the same thing. They were just like, yeah, it called out to me.
Sure. Like,
yeah. I guess this is it,
Yeah. This is the life path. Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. you mentioned, and I know that like almost every single interview that you've done, people talk about, being alcohol and drug free still. At this point it clearly is like who you are rather than obviously a label you put on yourself. I mean, yeah. that is the reality. Now that people, interact with you and you've obviously, traveled through what I like to call the civilian world for many years now, how do people react to you where it's just like, wait, what do you mean you don't drink? Like, drugs? No, you've never done them. Like, how do people, process that with you?
I don't recall it being, I don't think it really has been a thing. Like, I didn't do that stuff at an early, I did when I was young. I tried all of it. I tried drinking with all my teenage buddies and smoking pot. And I even tried, they had the crosstop, they call them, they had all kinds of names for them, but it was basically speed. And I had friends, I remember in high school, that would take it and they would just, you know, fly through classes. And I remember I tried it and it just made me so uneasy and I was sweating and I was like grinding my teeth. And I was just like, why would this be a good thing? Like, there's nothing fun about this at all. It's just like, you know, so, but all of my adult life, I just never did it. And, you know, of course we got kind of lumped into the straight edge thing because we were early on, we were a part of a scene that kind of just said, no, we were, you know, friends with Minor Threat. We played shows together and we kind of identified with them in the sense that we were all just underage, you know, or young people who didn't sort of subscribe to whatever it was that you're supposed to subscribe to when you turn 16 or 17 or whatever. But we just kind of got lumped into that. And you know, I never identified as straight edge. And it's funny because I'll see old interviews, you know, I'll see like old interviews where from like 84 where I'm saying, well, we're not really straight edge. I guess you could say we're straight. But, you know, I was always trying to make that, you know, just make that clear because I kind of early on sensed that it was going to go in a direction that I just thought was going to be too restrictive and too militant and stupid. And I was right. Everything about it just kind of turned into this nightmarish, you know, it made for a lot of negativity in the music scene itself, the underground music scene. And, you know, kids would get beaten up for drinking a beer or even wearing a band t-shirt that was identified for being beer drinkers, you know, just stupid shit like that. And so I immediately just wasn't into it, but it is who I am. You know, I just never found the need for it. I never found that much interest in it. And, I've had just as much fun and I've gotten in just as much trouble as anybody I know that's been a stoner or an alcoholic. So I just feel like I don't judge anybody. You know, I've grown up around alcoholism and I've had some of my closest friends have really, you know, almost succumbed to that. So it's a serious deal and I don't treat it lightly. You know, I don't look down on it and I try not to judge anybody based on, you know, but yeah, it's just one of those things I've never really thought about too much unless somebody brings it up.
Right. Exactly. <It's> like, no, for sure. For sure. Especially too, when it's like, it kind of, you know, especially with the labeling of yourself, like, I mean, I'm, you know, 40 years old, like I mentioned, and you know, I label myself a straight edge, but it's like, I don't need to do that. Like, because most people I would say that to are just like, well, what is that? Who cares? Right. And the people that do know that, it's like, well, I mean, okay, cool. But like now you're just an adult. You don't have like, there's nothing that's really, you could just say you're a non-drinker or sober or whatever. But I'm like, well, if I do that, then, you know, the dumb kids that have labeled themselves straight edge will win. And I can't let that happen.
Well, yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I, there was a time where I think it was good to identify if you felt right. I understood why. And I think I probably started, I did lean into that a little bit. And I know my brother Steve did too, but it's just, yeah, you know, because it's kind of like it needed to sort of like what the idea was so unpopular in the beginning at the time that Minor Threat sort of made it a thing, that it gave a lot of people around not even the country, around the world, just sort of this like, it was nice to have something to rally around that wasn't like promoting stupid like decadence and just being out of your fucking head all the time. And I also, because I was putting on so many shows when I was younger, I knew what it took to just get a hall, somebody that owned a hall or a club to let me come in and book a show. The work that it would take to just to convince them, let alone the money that I'd have to scrape up and finding a PA system. And, you know, I mean, we didn't do security or any of that stuff, but it was just kind of like, there would always be the one kid that would come there who had been drinking out in the parking lot and then would just come in and wreak havoc and start shit. And I just was like, there was just zero tolerance in my mind. Like probably the last few times in my life I've been physically violent was in that situation where I was just like, you're not going to destroy what so many of us want and are working hard to keep going. And if I have to beat the shit out of you, and maybe you'll beat the shit out of me, but it's going to happen, you know? And I was really, really adamant about it. And I think that's why in Reno, at least, people, there was this sense that, oh, the guys in 7 Seconds are like straight edge Nazi guy, you know? And it was never the case. It was just like, you know, we have this thing that we all want and you want to be here. And it's like, why are you fucking breaking the mirror in the women's bathroom? Like, why are you doing this dumb shit that, you know, go home and do that stuff, you know, like don't do it here. So yeah, so my own young mind, I would attribute that to just being somebody that was out of their minds drunk. And then, you know, it was easy to just go, you know, see why I hate this shit?
Right.
But again, yeah. You know, like as I've grown up and I've gotten to have a better understanding of it, you know, I do have empathy for anybody that has a problem with any of that stuff, you know, and I feel like to just be straight edge and just say, well, fuck them, that's they're weak or whatever, you know, I never related to that mentality. I just never thought that was it just didn't make sense to me.
Sure. Well, and plus, you know, considering the broad tent that you have built the band around and in, like, you want to be as welcoming to as many people as possible. And like, clearly when you're drawing that dividing line in some aspect, like that, you know, that,
right.
That's the antithesis of what Seconds is about. So like, yeah. And kind of on that same tip where, you know, when the band started and like you started to, you know, tour and kind of get out there because, you know, a lot of these, you know, paths that you were traveling on, you know, had not really been toured before. Like, you know, yes, yeah. You were, you know, falling down the road of, you know, whether it's Minor Threat or Black Flag or anything like that. But, you know, how, like, did you enjoy touring initially? Or was it one of those things where it's like, holy moly, like, this is not what I, like, bargained for or anything like that?
Not only did I enjoy it, I still enjoy it. Like, I still really love, I mean, it's harder now, I gotta admit, because the last few tours I've done have been as a solo guy, and I'm just me and my van driving around the country, you know, alone, and you know, sleeping in and out of the van. But there is a part of it that just, I think maybe because my family, we moved around so much when we were kids, there was always this, as much as I hated moving and I hated changing school districts and all that stuff, it was kind of fun and liberate, you know, it made me appreciate my mom, even though that's part of the reason my mom always felt really kind of shitty later on in life. Like, I just moved us around a lot. Da, da, da. Like, yeah, but it was kind of fun. We always had fun, you know. It was like, it was exciting moving into a new place and getting to know new people, you know. But I do have a sense. I do love to travel, and I like to. My wife would laugh. My wife Allison would laugh hearing that because she's always trying to. She's like, we should go, you know, travel and go, you know. But I'm not like a vacation guy. I like to travel with meaning. You know what I mean? Like, I like to have a work to do when I get to some place, you know. So. But yeah, I loved it right from the beginning, and I took to it. I felt like I was just sort of I was ready to travel and get out there and just not have too many. I mean, back, you know, we're talking like what 81, 82 when we really first started to hit the road a lot. You know, there was no everybody was stupid. Everybody, all the band people that we knew, the people that were helping to book shows, nobody had. I mean, some people didn't even have driver's licenses or I remember I had a van and I didn't have, it wasn't registered. You know, they didn't have like current tags or whatever. And we would just do stupid shit like that. We'd just go to LA and hope for the best. Hope we didn't get pulled over, you know, like, and it was all just really fun. And it felt like we were doing something really big and important, you know, at least for us. I loved that. I loved all of it. You know, even the really rough stuff, like, you know, just staying at houses with sketchy people and having to worry about, you know, your equipment getting stolen or, you know, crazy weird shows where there was violence going on, you know, all of it was just contributed to like getting a better sense of society and humanity as a whole, I guess, in some way. I don't know how, but it did, you know. So I like it. I still think it's I still sort of romanticize a little bit about it, but and I should know better because I know how lame and hard it can be, especially when you're I just turned 60, so it's like the idea of being, you know, 60 in a van, I'm sure I could do it really well, and I'm you know, I have it down, but I'm like, I don't know, there's something kind of crazy about that. It's like,
yeah, oh no, for sure. Yeah, I mean, because touring is, you know, means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and you know, your relationship can ebb and flow over time, but you know, right. Just that notion of what you're talking about, of the idea that, like, yes, this sort of general pursuit of, you know, new experiences is something I enjoy. And that's, you know, that's at the core of it, you know, why people kind of get out there and, you know, travel and tour and stuff.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
It kind of hitting on the notion that, you know, once you guys started to, you know, develop a following and like the idea of, you know, working with other record labels besides like BYO and kind of, you know, spread your wings a little bit and the business implications of like, oh my gosh, like, we got paid $500 to play a show or whatever. Like, you know, just these things that like were not ever in your scope of understanding. You know, how did that kind of hit you as you started to try to like navigate the professional side of being, you know, the music business, as it were? Was that something that you just try to keep it at an arm's length, or did you actually, you know, kind of enjoy that process?
It's so different now, of course, and now there's no. Now the business kind of there's a real keen sense of like being part of some industry or some business. Back then, that did not exist. Like you could, even if you were signed to a record label, I mean, we didn't even hire an attorney until probably 15 years after we'd already been a band. You know, our first couple of deals with BYO or, you know, it was mostly handshake stuff. We had an agreement, but we didn't really know how to read it. And we didn't want to, we almost felt like by bringing an attorney into the situation, even though everybody and their mother who was smart and who were our friends said, get a lawyer, get a lawyer, get a lawyer. We felt like it was almost like, just like sacrilege. Like it was just awful to even like, this is about community, man. No, we're not, none of us are here to hurt each other, you know? And I did, I was that naive and I was that kind of foolish to think that that was really what we were kind of dealing with. And I, because I wanted that to be the reality, you know, but yeah, later on we realized, we started to understand like, oh, you know, there's interest in the band. People are making money off the band. We're making money off the band. I guess we really should start thinking a little, being a little smarter about it, whatever. And, you know, we finally got a booking agent and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's just like, it's funny. I go through, I've been trying to kind of go back and find, I'd like do a, almost like a, just a, like a listing of all the shows we've ever played. And for the first 5 years I had that in a book and I ended up losing it, but I'm kind of going back and there's various things online. You can look up different bands, like their concert list or whatever. And it's funny to see, like, you'll see Black Flag would play like the Mabuhay Gardens in San Francisco, sometimes twice a month, but definitely once a month, you know. Nowadays that like the, no band would go and play the same market. You know, you wouldn't even call it a market, you know, they'd never play the same city like twice a year. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, there'd be some kind of clause, some contract that said, you know, radius clause or some crazy thing. So it's all really different. And I admit, I don't understand how it's done now. Like if I didn't have a booking agent, I really wouldn't understand. In my mind, it's still like, hey, you know, how about we let's do a bunch of shows 3 months from now. It was like, nobody books 3 months, you know, like now everybody's booking already. Like people are already booking in 2020, you know, 22 or whatever. And so I still have that mentality where it's just like, I appreciate the underground aspects of it and the sort of the spontaneous of like, hey, you guys want to do a show? Yeah, of course we want to do a show. Can you pay us anything? Yeah, we can, you know, we'll give you $50 and we'll feed you. Okay, sounds good. You know, those days are over. And it's kind of, I kind of hate that they are. I mean, on my own level and again, as a performer or whatever, I still try and keep that open. Like I'm always telling Margie, my booking agent, I'm like, you know, I'm happy that you can get me money playing at a club, and that's probably what's going to bankroll this whole thing. But I still want to be able to play at some kid's basement or play at a record store or play at a clothing, you know, like a thrift store. I like doing that kind of stuff, and I don't really care that it's nice to make money, but it's not the thing that's going to stop me from playing the show if I don't make money, you know, and you're not really, that's not really a smart way to do things, but I can't quite shake that. So, you know, I just try to, I try to gauge, you know, but yeah, it's a whole different thing now. And, you know, we're getting, especially now with this crew reissue thing going, everybody's like, so are you guys going to tour again? And it's like, nah, you know, we pretty much, when we said we broke up, we broke up, you know, I mean, I never say never. I'm not that stupid, but I also am like, you know, we're all, you know, older and not as in shape as we'd like to be. And there's, if the four of us were like, hey, what do you think? Want to do a show? Want to do two shows? If everybody was into it, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But yeah, it would, the whole dynamic now, we just got a crazy offer to open a show for a really big name band. And the money was so insane. And my first thought was like, I just want to say yes, because we could all use that money. But then my other thought is like, we never took a show based off because of money. And there's no reason now that we're sort of retired to start doing that now. And so, yeah, it's a crazy you know, you start thinking about that stuff and you kind of wish that you didn't have those, you don't want it to pop up in your head, especially like at this stage, you know, it's just.
Yeah. Right. Well, and plus it's like that idea, like, you know, when you do get to the point of, it's like, oh yeah, dude, do you want to play, you know, with the Foo Fighters at Wembley Stadium? And it's like, first of all, that would never even occur to me. And like, would that even, you know, you kind of distill it like, okay, the money's great, but then like, would that actually be fun? Like, would
anything, exactly.
You know, and like, you have to parse through, like, not only, you know, does the financial gain, like, that's cool, but like, are all these other things in line? And if they don't feel right, then yeah, I can understand why you would say no, even if it's like, you know, a stupid offer or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that's kind of, you know, yeah, exactly. Like, and you do, you know, you do sort of, I don't know. I mean, I also, you know, over the years we were also like, you know, I remember we got offered to do the Warped Tour and we were like, we were always sort of like, we were always talking shit about the Warped Tour, you know, it was just the thing to do. And we had friends that went on it and had weird experiences. And it just, we were always like, you know, who needs a Warped Tour? And then we got asked to do it, you know, and it was like the, you know, we could play, you know, as many dates as we wanted, you know, they were going to put us on the main stage, they would put us on the side stage, we're going to be all over the place. And so the first thing we did is like, well, let's see what the rest of the lineup looked like. Let's see if there's going to be friends that are going to be playing. You know, if we know that we've got friends that are on the thing, you know, on the tour, then at least we know that part of it will be fun, you know? So then it was like, finally we said yes, because it was like, yeah, there's like five friends of ours that are playing on the bill. We get to share a bus with H2O. We're all buddies. We don't have to drive ourselves. We don't even have to feed ourselves. Like, bands eat amazingly well on the Warped Tour. And yeah, we probably won't make the money that we'd make if we were headlining our own club date, you know, every night, but it'll be an experience that we, if we do it and it ends up being bad, then we can say, ah, see, we knew all along it was going to be a lame situation, or, hey, it turned out to be better than we thought it was going to be, you know? So yeah, it was like, you know, there, we've made these decisions where we get asked to play something and we've turned things down, plenty of things down, but it's also like, you know, we've never turned down, like in the situation, like, hey, the Foo Fighters invited you. I'd go, hey, you know, the Foo Fighters are fine. I don't have any problems with that. But then I would start thinking like, and Dave Grohl seems like a nice guy. You know, he's been really supportive of bands of our, you know, our ilk or whatever. But then I'd start thinking like, okay, shit, do we have to get up early to go have a sound check at like noon? You know, do we have to drive to, how do we get access into the stadium? You know, I'd be thinking of all of this stuff.
Right.
And I'd be like, that's where I'd be like, nope, forget it. I'm out. It's like,
totally. Yeah. Like this doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
There definitely comes a time, you know, I mean, especially because, you know, punk rock and hardcore in general is obviously a youth-based culture. And, you know, that notion of, you know, quote unquote, aging gracefully within the context of punk and hardcore, like, you know, that means different things to different people.
Right.
And, you know, how, like, I mean, you are still clearly prolific in regards to all the music and art that you put out, you know, but how, I guess, how do you subvert the idea of like being that, you know, whatever, bitter old man on the porch being like, oh man, like punk and hardcore used to be so great 15 years ago or whatever, you know, like, and I'm sure that is a thought that crosses your mind, but you know, do you, or maybe you don't even think about that. You know, how does that kind of, I guess, ping pong around your brain?
I struggle with it probably every day. If I'm online, if I'm on social media and I see a mention of something, or I see someone telling a story that I sort of relate to, or I can vouch for, or whatever. I, you know, I always have an opinion and I always have to fight chiming in, because I realize that you can be just that sort of grouchy old know-it-all that everybody is just go, you know, that, I mean, there's a reason for a, you know, hashtag okay boomer, you know, there's a reason for that. Yeah. Hashtag. And I understand it. I totally get it. And I really do. I try as best I can to not be that old guy, and I fail, because I still have people go, you know, Kev, I love your post, man. You're such a grouchy old man. And I'm like, God, I didn't think I was even being grouchy in that post. I thought I was being like, you know, I thought I was being kind of funny and cute, and you know, and that's the other thing too, is like, there's a, you know, there's a misunderstanding of that. But I'm not bitter. I don't feel bitter. Like I have more people. It's always loving friends or people that really grew up with 7 Seconds and love, still profoundly love the band. They're the ones that always plant it in my head that like, we never got the you know, the attention that we deserve. And it's, I won't even think about it until someone says, man, it just kills me that you guys, you know, this, there was a list of top 20 da da da, and you guys aren't on it, or, you know, and I'm like, wow, I wasn't even thinking about this, but now you got me thinking about it. You know, should I be pissed? You know,
should I care? Right.
I had this conversation with Ian McKay not long ago. And I just said, whenever we talk, it's always we always inevitably will get around to this, something like this subject. And he said, yeah, he goes, are you kidding? You guys kind of like lived it in, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, you guys lived a dream. You lived a dream that, you know, you had this little dream. You did not got to travel all around the world. You made a little money. You got to, you know. I'm like, yeah, that's it. I mean, that's in my mind. That's what I carry around with me most of the time, you know? So yeah, I it's important for me to not be that old boring grouchy guy. And sometimes I think it comes out. I'll notice it lyrically in the last few 7 Seconds records where I'm probably just having this internal discussion in my own brain based on like a conversation I had with somebody or something I saw on social media. And then I'll sort of opine on it openly. And then all of a sudden it becomes a song. And I realize, wow, that really could just be another, you know, you suck, you don't, you know, you suck and I don't kind of thing that the hardcore is kind of, at least early hardcore was always kind of known for. We were always like pointing fingers and telling the world what's wrong, but we really weren't necessarily suggesting a solution, you know? And so, yeah, that's it. I think it creeps up. I don't think you can be 60 and not have it, you know, creep up a little bit, but I think the key is to just try to keep yourself in check. And anybody that I know that's close to my age from this sort of world, it kind of agrees, you know, we're like, yeah, you know, we still want to be somehow like, I still want to be inspirational if at all possible to younger people. Like, I don't want people look at me and go, oh, if that's what I got to look forward to, forget it. You know, like I'd rather people, I also get this thing a lot where people go, oh, you know, you're such a positive guy. You just, everything you say is so positive and encouraging. And I'm like, you really don't know me. Like, that's not who I am, but it's important for me to try to be, because I know that bands, who said something or said something in a song, the way the Clash is a great example. You know, the Clash said so many things lyrically, and just hearing their music and the energy and the way they put everything together just was always encouraging to me. It was always like, hey, young people, if I can do this, you can do this, you know? And I think it's important to do if that's your thing. Like, I think it's, if you can step up and still, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
I get the idea, because yeah, you, there definitely is a fine line between, like, I think the most, you know, bummed out people get is when it's always talking about the previous thing being so much better than the current thing.
Right.
And like, I think that's where you kind of, you know, lose the thread. And that's when people become old and jaded, where it's like, oh yeah, obviously hardcore died when Negative Approach broke up or whatever. It's exactly. Just like, what, who, that's what you say. Like, that's your fault, you know? And that's, well, not.
And I had to learn the hard way, because I would do that. You know, somebody would be, I remember in the 90s that would happen a lot, where somebody would be talking about how great that's what it was. Like, people would go, man, you guys had it made, you know, you had a great scene, all the bands were good. And I'm like, yeah, but we had fucking everybody hated us, you know? It was like, we had, you know, rednecks and cops and people in the military and our parents, and like, everybody really hated what was going on. Like, it wasn't easy to get on a bus and go somewhere, or it wasn't easy to ride your skateboard or ride your bike without getting harassed. But then I realized that is, I'm doing that same thing. I'm just going, back in my day, we got the shit kicked out of us for walking to the post office or whatever. So yeah, it's just, it is one of those things where, again, it's just balance and, you know, trying to find the balance of being, you know, I mean, you don't want to underplay or under, you don't want to like dismiss what your life, your own life experience and what you've gone through. But it's like, yeah, most young people really don't care really what your opinion is on what they're doing now. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't.
Sure.
I didn't. You know, it's like, I didn't want to hear somebody that was 40, 50, 60 years old tell me that, well, you're kind of doing it wrong. You know, like it's just, even if they are, you know, it's, there's no point to it. It's just
totally right. Yeah. Cause you're like, well, let me figure that out, old man.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and that's what I said. I said the same thing. Like, well, I don't need you to tell me how to do this, you know? And it, the truth is I probably did need that, but I just, I needed to learn. I needed to fall on my own face 25,000 times. And some people just need to go through that. They don't need to use your experience to teach them. And if they do, they'll let you know. If they want advice or they ask you something, try and be accessible, try and be gracious and humble and speak from your heart. And I think you're on the right path.
Yeah, absolutely. Two last things I want to hit on before I let you go was the, because music and your pursuit of it, you know, is clearly hardwired in you. But there definitely is a, you know, distinction between, you know, like having to do it and then still caring about it. But I think, in my opinion, you definitely blend the two together appropriately because, you know, there are definitely, artists where it's just like, you don't care about this, but you have to, like, you're just doing this because, you know, whatever. It's like performative or,
I'm just kidding.
No, I know, but I mean, you put me on the spot. So it's like, I'm trying to think of an example, but like, yeah, I mean, nothing comes to my head, but, and I know you're joking, but, just that idea of, you know, a person, having to live up to whatever expectation that like, it's like, oh, they are this person from this band or whatever. So like, I constantly need to be this person regardless of anything else that surrounds me. But like you combine your artistic output with the fact that like, you still truly do care about it. And I guess in simplest of terms, like why do you still care? Like, I know that's a big question. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think for us is that we over the years did pretty well, and we got some recognition. Like there have been times where I know that people were like, oh yeah, they were one of the bigger hardcore bands in the '80s or whatever. But I don't think we like, if I look at us compared to like, say some of our, you know, like, I don't know, Bad Religion or I'm trying to think of really big bands that from that era, Descendants, bands that we played shows with, we kind of grew up with and came up from the same thing. We were really never like a name brand punk band. You know, we did well. People, you know, a lot of kids got into us and stayed into us. Some people dropped off for whatever reason. But we never had that. I never had a sense of ourselves as being like this band that was just so big that we were stuck to any. And that's one of the reasons I think we felt the freedom to just do whatever we wanted musically. In the 80s, you know, we started to change things quite drastically. And you know, we went from being the kind of sweethearts of the underground punk hardcore punk rock scene to being like, why do they sound like U2? Like, why are they doing this now? You know, people got really, it took it personally even. And so I think because we just sort of always just did whatever the fuck we wanted and maybe because we were like little hicks from Reno even, I don't even know. I mean, I've considered this. Maybe we were just too dumb to know any better, you know, and we didn't have a sense of like where we sat, you know, status wise in all of it. So there was never a sense that we needed to live up. At least I feel like I never felt a sense of needing to live up to anything other than, if we make it to your town and we make it to the venue, we will do everything we can to help you have fun. And we want to have fun with you. You know, it's not, we don't want to just be entertainers for the night. We don't want you to just, you know, here's the music, everybody. Now go home, get our money. Like, let's just have a great fucking night together. Let's not fight. Let's not hurt each other. And then we'll move on, you know? And that was kind of always the sort of quiet guarantee. Like, we're not going to try to, I'm not trying to change your world. If you're inspired, if some things I've said resonate with you, that's awesome. You know, I love it. And I'll never shit on that. But I also feel like, it was always just about fun and just appreciating the community that we're all part of at that moment. And whatever happens tomorrow happens tomorrow, you know, whatever happens when so-and-so come in town and play, that may be a whole different thing, you know? And really it never changed for us. I don't think we ever had a sense of that changing really. I think we always went, that's one of the reasons that I, you know, people would say, what's it like being a band for 35 years? You know, and sometimes I'd think, oh, yeah, that's right. We've been around that long. But I'd think, hey, we just had a 300-mile van ride together and none of us, we still like each other. We still love each other. We still joke and we still have fun hanging out at a Denny's or whatever. I don't know. I guess it feels pretty good. As long as we don't suck on stage and we don't look like a bunch of boring old men, I think we're doing okay, you know? And that's how it is. I mean, our last, you know, the last couple of tours of 7 Seconds, you know, prior to us calling it a day, we had phenomenal shows. You know, we went on a US tour. It did really well. There were a lot of young people coming to shows. I've seen videos since then, and we don't all look like a bunch of, you know, just like stick in the mud. Like we look like we're digging it, you know? And I remember going, wow, that was an amazing show. So, you know, again, I can't really complain. And I don't mean to sound like I'm trying to live up to some posse core, you know, guru guy, but I really do feel like we just, we did it until it just, we physically couldn't do it anymore for a number of reasons, both, you know, physical and mental, emotional, but also just the fun stayed intact the entire time, you know. And I know tomorrow, if we were all feeling good and everybody was, you know, in the right spirits and we went out and got on the stage, I know we'd have an amazing time. And I think the people who would be there to see us would have a great time as well. So,
yeah.
There's that. Well,
I really like that. Not only were you following the muse artistically, but then at the core of it, you're just like trying to keep it distilled down to the simplest components. And that is what, you know, keeps yourself prolific and obviously the band's health at the forefront rather than, you know, chasing, yeah, commercial stardom or whatever. Like you said, you know, it's like once you guys decided to, you know, be the band that you were and not just continually, you know, write the same record over and over, that, you know, that could have led you down the road of not releasing music ever again.
Right, for sure. And you know, like you mentioned earlier, and I joked about it, but there are, we all have seen the bands that have been around just a little too long and they look miserable and they're, you know, if you've traveled with a band or played shows with a band and you see how things are backstage or, you know, outside, you know, before the show or after the show, you're just going, why are you still doing this? Like, it can't be the money. Like, if we're all both, you know, sharing a stage in a club that holds 600 people, you know, none of us are making so much money that the money is why we do this, you know? So I remember going and seeing a couple bands on big outdoors, you know, punk bands on big outdoor stages. And I remember whispering to my wife saying, like, please, I know you love me and you'd never want to hurt my feelings, but if you ever see me looking that miserable and completely disconnected from everything that's around me at that moment, whatever it takes, do what you can to tell me, you know, like I don't want
my legs, right?
something like I just that was always my biggest, I don't know if it was a fear, but I always just thought, I just don't ever want to look that uninterested and disconnected. And meanwhile, you know, the band, I've seen a couple bands like that. They're raking it in. They're making so much money. And I'm like, I guess that's it. I guess at that point you're like, well, you know, we don't have to struggle. We're traveling around in a nice fancy bus or we're flying to and from gigs. I guess, you know, you have to come to your own, you have to do your own inventory and figure out that's what it's about, you know? And I'm not going to judge if that's what you're into and everybody's into it. That's what it is, you know? But yeah, on our personal little thing, we were just always like, I always tried to bring it up every once in a while without trying to be the bummer of the band. And I just said, like, you know, are you sure you're having fun? Even before every tour, I'd be like, are you sure you're into this? Like, I don't want this to be a thing you feel like you have to do it because you're going to make more money in 2 weeks doing this than you would at your shitty job at home. You know, like, please tell me now if that's the deal, because I don't want to do this. And you know, I think we all really would think long and hard about it and just say, all right, we're in, this is why we're doing it. And it was all good,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, for sure. And the last thing was, you know, on that tip with the fact that, you know, the re-release of The Crew and everything like that, you know, it's exciting for a multitude of reasons. One, the fact that this music and could live on, you know, digitally for, you know, children to consume in the year's future.
Right.
And then also just, you know, appropriately documenting, you know, the vinyl re-release and having, you know, so many different elements that make it, you know, ultimately meaningful for you and then meaningful for people that this record resonates with. Did you just feel like because, you know, you were able to find Joe and Trust Records, like it was just kind of like right place, right time scenario? Or had this idea been kind of like percolating for a while? It was just a matter of, you know, finding the appropriate vehicle for it.
We didn't find Joe and Trust. They found us, and I actually have known Joe for years, and I love him. He's a friend and whatever. We're at a point now where a lot of our records are sort of hitting this mark, you know, to where it's a weird thing, because my biggest beef with a lot of our records still is that they're just unavailable. You can't find them on physical form. You can't find them on social media. They're not being streamed, and I might not even think about it, except that I just have, I still am plugged in. Not so, I'm the only one in the band really that stays plugged into the social media thing. So I'm always reading stuff and I'm always getting emails and messages saying, how come I can't find blah, blah, blah on Spotify or whatever. And I when I realize I have no answer, I don't even know, like I'm so disconnected from like past record label obligations and publishing stuff and all this stuff, that it starts to get, it's kind of like when you haven't worked out and you gain a bunch of weight and you're like, man, I just don't even know where to begin. Like, I feel like I might as well just eat another, you know, something, because it's a terrible analogy, but I just, you get stuck in your own head of what to do. And so people were, I even had lawyers contacting me saying, hey, you know, the rights to this album it can be reverted back to you. If you get them, you can do whatever you want with it. You can release it yourself or you can have somebody else. So that stuff was kind of starting to come up, and we were very unhappy with the fact that all the stuff on BYO was unavailable on Spotify. I know Spotify's evil and all this other shit, but ultimately, and I've talked to a number of my peers in the scene that I love and respect a lot. Ultimately, we all just want our music, the music that we worked really hard to make and get out and keep out and promote. We just want it available, especially at this stage in our lives, because, you know, there are younger people that are getting into this music all the time. And if they don't have access to it, you know, in the ways that kids now get access to it, it's kind of, it's defeating the whole thing. Like, why does a record even exist if you're not going to, you know? So I was really happy. Initially when I talked to Joe, when they approached us, I was kind of standoffish, and I just said, dude, I got to admit, I'm so fed up with just the record label shit and just this and that and all the talk. And I'm like, you know, give me an idea what you guys are thinking about, and I'll talk to the guys about it. And Joe just really made a very compelling, like, he just laid it out. He said, look, we're fans first and foremost, you know, we want to do right by these records, and we believe we can do it. And we wouldn't want to do anything that would, you guys would be bummed out. You guys will be involved at every aspect of it. If you don't want to be involved at all, that's fine too. And everything was just, we just had these great discussions, and I talked to him, you know, I talked to Joe more than anybody really. And I thought, well, and they, technically they picked up the rights to the BYO records, so they can release this stuff legally and just do it. And not even consult us. They'd have to pay us, you know, but in terms of royalties and stuff, but they could just do it. You know, they didn't have to, you know, make sure that we felt comfortable and good about this whole thing. But at every turn, there's just been, I mean, I just said, look, I'm a hands-on guy. I always have been. And even if I've made mistakes, they're my mistakes on behalf of the band trusts me enough to let me do it. So, you know, if you want there to be goodwill between us, then just guarantee me that you're not going to do underhanded shit in the name of marketing. And, you know, even if you think it's a good idea, at least run it by us first, because nobody knows this band better than us and how we want to be represented. And as much as I know that we all want the crew to be sold to, you know, the millions of youth out there, the reality is that, I mean, my thing always is like, look, the people that want the crew probably have the crew, but it's this whole new life now. There's the, you know, it's been remastered, which is something I wanted to do forever. It's back to its original form, you know, back to the original colors, which there was always a dispute about that. We never wanted it to be anything but the black, white, and red. And these guys have just committed. They said, look, we're down. Let's do it. Tell us what you want. We'll work with you on it and stuff. And so you know, here we are in 2021. I mean, I kind of stopped doing interviews because I just got kind of tired of, I wasn't really promoting anything. And I sort of felt like, what am I talking about? You know, I'm talking about stuff that happened 40 years ago. But because of all this stuff, I told them, I said, look, if you need, you know, me to do interviews or press stuff, I'm in. I'm not excited. And I'm not a big fan of that stuff anymore. But I want to, you know, I think it's worth it. And I think the record is, you know, I think the record's a great record. And I think that, you know, this new re-release deserves a shot, you know, deserves a little exposure and stuff. So, yeah. I'm pretty excited about it. And I feel really good about the situation with Trust. I think they've got all the right ideas. And, you know, it's kind of cool that they did the Circle Jerks record. We're buddies with the Circle Jerks and, you know, been friends with Keith forever. And I'm really happy that we got to do something, you know, kind of on the same label, you know? So
totally.
Yeah. There's like, it's at this point, and I'll shut up at this point, really, it's all about before I die. And I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I would just love to know that all of our music is available to whoever wants it. Like I don't care if it's on free or pay, whatever. I just want everything that we've ever done to be available in some form or fashion. And I'll be very, very happy about that. And hey, look, if it sells and I keel over, at least I know my family will benefit from, you know, like my wife will. So that's kind of, that's been our attitude from the beginning of this whole thing. And it's been really, really cool so far. I'm really quite pleased with how it's turned out so far.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And it does, like you said, it just gives the opportunity for people, because the scene is so mature now. It's going on, you know, 40 plus years.
I know
that you have to have the ability to access music in whatever delivery mechanism is important to that particular generation. And like, for sure. if it's just not there, then it's just not there. And then that gets like lost to time. And that's something that shouldn't happen with, you know, classic records like The Crew and a lot of other things that you have done. So,
well, yeah. Yes. And it's just, especially if you're going like, well, it's not available because, you know, so-and-so rips bands off. And it's like, I don't want to give into the, like, oh, well, that's how it is. But that's kind of how it's been forever, you know. Like we've all gotten dicked around by distributors and you know, record labels and stuff. So it's like, well, at this point, let's just make sure the music's out there. And if you want to figure out a better way to get your cut of it, that's up to you. But you know, let's just keep the music out there. We didn't write it and record it and tour behind it just to have it sit quietly somewhere. You know, it just doesn't make sense to us. You know, it's counter what we've worked our butts off all of these years to try and do, you know? So.
Yep. Oh no, for sure. I totally agree. Well, Kevin, thank you for letting me ping pong around your life and your musical life and all that stuff. I just appreciate you letting me to pick your brain. So
yeah,
thank you.
It was really fun, Ray. I appreciate it.
Okay, I am so hyped that interview happened. Thank you very much to Bailey, his publicist. Thank you very much to Joe at Trust Records and Kevin for coming on the show and just being so, just a great dude. Like, you can tell he still cares about music. He still cares about all the things that he is doing currently, which a quick Google will trip you into his whole awesome. I mean, he's been doing live streams for a while, obviously, because there's no way to get out there and play shows. But yeah, 7 seconds. This is just a really, really important conversation for me. So love that. And next week, we have Mike Schleibaum, who's from Darkest Hour and Be Well and Battery and a ton of other bands. But I've known Mike for a long time. He actually gave me one of my first, like, sort of real full-fledged tour experience with my band Taken. We went out with Darkest Hour for, gosh, it was like maybe 3 to 4 weeks. And I learned a lot from him, just kind of observing how this band that was, you know, more professional than we for sure were. And Mike is just an incredible guy. So had to have him on the show because he has his own custom signature guitar. There's a lot of fun stuff that we dive into. So that is what's happening next week. And until then, please be safe, everybody.